Love this podcast? Support this show through the supporter feature from Acast. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
My guest today is Arna Kislenko, and this week we're going to talk about the Soviet invasion of Berlin, which, as you know, the Soviet came first to Berlin, and we're going to discuss the road the soldiers took to Berlin this week, and of course end with the victory parade in Stalingrad. But as always, how did you come to study this? You studied in general war history, and World War II is among them, because of how, where did your interest become in this? In war history, you know, of the 20th century?
Yeah, I mean, for me personally, it started with my family. My father fought the Second World War. My mom lived through the Second World War. So I grew up instilled with a lot of different things about the Second World War. They fought for different sides in different places, but that was a pretty constant narrative. And then, you know, became interested in history generally, but very specifically with the Second World War because of that. And then also my own studies. I pursued international relations, diplomatic history, and have done many, many things and specialized in other areas too. But the Second World War is a bit of a gravitational pull for me. I think a lot of the stories of the Second World War are not told. I know a lot of people say, you know, we've heard it all, but I would strongly disagree with that. There are different interpretations, a lot of missing components, documents that haven't been made available. So I've been naturally intrigued towards that. I teach this stuff. I teach particularly about the Second World War and Soviet effort. And then, of course, there is, you know, a component. I'm of Russian ancestry and all of those sort of things. But really, it's got nothing to do much with flags. I think when you look at the Second World War and you see its tremendous importance in every single sense of the word, to human history, not to mention the staggering loss of life, you know, one has to stop and pay particular attention. It's not to say other periods of history aren't important, but this one is extremely important. It's shaped the world in which we live in so many incalculable ways. And then last but not least, it is that dimension of suffering. When I first learned about the loss of life in the Soviet Union, I thought it was a mistake. Right. I think like most of my undergraduate students, you know, you think they must have said something wrong. Right. I've got that wrong. And that is something that's still with us today. I guarantee you I could walk into almost any classroom, including my own, and ask people, you know, how many people died in the Second World War, and they'd probably underestimate it. And that's particularly true when we look at the Soviet Union. Right. The losses there. I was taught as an undergrad many, many years ago, you know, something in the neighborhood of 10 to 15 million. And of course, now we've doubled that, right? So that to me has always been intriguing. As much as we do know about the Soviet war effort, there's so many things that we don't know. And it speaks fundamentally to our modern day relationship with Russia, frankly. This is, you know, the current war, Russian war in Ukraine is very much shaped by World War II narratives, different narratives, you know, ones that I don't support in any way. But, you know, we're basically seeing how the impact of the Second World War has shaped not just the global order, but very contemporary crises that we're dealing with in places like Ukraine. So for me, it's been a lifelong draw and a passion. And I think it's super important that we have these kind of discussions, particularly about you know, others, right? If you're American, you know, Americans don't generally regard much about the world in a lot of ways. From the Second World War, there's a narrative of victory, but they don't really calculate for other countries. And I'm sure that's true in other places too. So for me as an international historian, it's important to look at as many different narratives as possible, different countries and different people.
So let's begin with a little brief overview that led up to the Soviet invasion of Germany. So let's begin. So if you may, you we can talk about, from the Soviet in the interwar years.
Yeah, there's of course endless amounts we could talk about it. I always start with the interwar because it paints the picture of two really important things: the isolation of the Soviet Union and the international community, which instilled, I mean, I think it was caused by, but then it also furthered a very deep sense of paranoia that the Soviets had with respect to every other country. In some cases, rightly so, right? As we're about to talk about the German plans for the Soviet Union. But so that meant that to a large degree, the Soviet state in the interwar was a pariah. It was not involved in international proceedings in many respects, not a member of the League, had very few bilateral diplomatic recognitions with other countries. And all of that, of course, makes for a very complicated foreign policy, right, as we hit the Second World War. And then the second reason is that this also really, of course, revolves a lot around Joseph Stalin, who is, infamous in so many different ways, easily one of the greatest mass murderers in history and a ruthless dictator. Despite some people's romanticization of him, because of the Second World War and Soviet victory, I think it's important to acknowledge that this is a man who bled his country in many respects, was extraordinarily violent. And as a result, he set the stage for the Second World War in many different respects. That's not in any way to sort of, suggest what Hitler is about to do or anything like that is justified or something ridiculous. But this is a very fragile state as the Second World War begins. Despite its enormity and despite its tremendous military potential, it's a state which is weak in a lot of ways. That's demonstrated by the German invasion. And much of that has to do with Stalin. I think especially Russians have neglected that narrative, right? They've sort of glossed over those problems, internal problems. So I usually start there and point out, under Bolshevik rule and particularly Stalin, in the interwar period, you had massive purges, the so-called pogroms, political, social, cultural purges, killing approximately 7 million people. And then, of course, you had the forced economic collectivization programs, which led to, amongst other things, a tremendous famine in Ukraine, tantamount to genocide, right? And in that case, you're looking at least another 10 million dead. So, long before German soldiers ever stepped foot on the Soviet Union, you have lost something in the neighborhood of 15 million, on top of losses from the Soviet, from the Bolshevik Revolution and the Civil War. And it's not just sort of a number. They were heavily targeted, those losses, particularly in the pogroms and the purges. They were
And
heavily
I
targeted.
think it's especially Poles were targeted as well as the enemy of the states.
Well, there's a lot of ethnic minorities in the country that are purged, right? There's mass deportations. There's of course the gulags. The Gulag Archipelago begins. But at its core, I mean, everybody suffers in the Soviet state, but of course, very relevant to today, especially if you're Ukrainian, is the idea that this was targeting, the idea of a separate Ukraine, of Ukrainian nationalism writ large. But at the end of the day, I always point out, very relevant to the Second World War, those losses are unimaginable in any other country, right? Let's be honest. With the possible exception of a country like China, the absorption of 10 to 15 million dead in less than 20 years is staggering, right? Something the Americans or Brits have never really encountered. But even more relevant to the Second World War is the target of it, meaning the purging of particular classes and occupations. And top of that list are the military. The Soviet military is ruthlessly purged in the interwar period, for no, for really a very clear reason. It's not for just sort of laughs that Stalin goes after them. He is terrified that from within the Soviet military there may emerge a political rival, a challenger. Right. And against the backdrop of Stalin's rise to power, he saw fit to get rid of everybody. So generals in that light are fair game. And that's why so many of them are purged. So many of the officer corps are purged. So what you have by the time, and some really great historians, you know, about the Soviet era talk about this as a priority for a reason. By the time you reach 1939, and then of course the German invasion of 1941, the Soviet military has been gutted. A lot of senior military men are no longer there. The officer corps, right? So as you go down that sort of system, the officer corps for men responsible for, you know, battalion level and company level kind of deployments, they are inexperienced. Many of them are reservists or have been called up for war. So from a very, you know, practical sense, if you like, this has a long-term and dire effect on the Soviet state. So the weakness of the Soviet Union that's evident to everybody in the first, you know, a couple of years of the war, for me, it really has its genesis in the interwar period. It's Stalin's fault, you know, to put a key point on it. And of course, that's a huge failing. So, yes, although he's going to emerge victorious and everything else at the end of the war, we can't gloss over the brutality of the regime in the interwar period and the animosities that it naturally fed in some of the constituent republics, right, in the SSRs, Belarus and Ukraine in particular. You know, that shouldn't surprise anybody that at least some Ukrainians welcomed the Nazis as liberators in 1941, right, when they come storming in. So I usually start there, and it's for those two reasons. It's international isolation. It has no friends and allies fundamentally, and it's quite weak from within. And even though it has great industrial potential and has built a modern army to a large degree, it is not prepared in any way for what's about to come.
You mentioned the purging of generals, and I remember reading about the Second World War recently, where he writes about how the General Sukho, who we definitely are coming back to eventually, he wrote a farewell letter to his wife because he was sent into the Kremlin, and he thought he was going to die. He thought he wouldn't come back because, you know, he thought he was going to get purged himself.
Yeah. And that's a very real fear. I mean, my students usually laugh for some reason. I think it's nervous laughter when I talk about those things, because, of course, they can't imagine it living in a nice, you know, democratic society like ours. They can't imagine the randomness of it all, right? The lawlessness of it all. But that's precisely what it was. So that's not an unusual account. Zhukov and others had to worry about their heads because so many of their comrades met that fate. Right. And that fear factor isn't just a sort of, you know, anecdote. It's I get really distressed when people say that it has a functional effect. So I do a lot on intelligence. So imagine if you're a Soviet intelligence officer, your job is to find out truths. Right. Not particular nice truths, not truths that the boss wants to hear, but truths, right? The reality of what you and your nation can and cannot do, what's going on and so on. But in this system, especially with Stalin at the top, if you were to deliver news that was disagreeable to anybody in that chain of command, particularly the big boss in the Kremlin, your life is over, flat out. So guess what happens, right? So, you know, I teach a course on intelligence, and generally Soviet intelligence is quite capable from a technical vantage point. It's lacking in some respects, especially in communications intelligence, but, you know, it's well oiled. It's got some pretty smart people, whether you like them or not is another issue, but it's fundamentally corrupt in sort of the same way that the Nazis will be fundamentally corrupt, because the boss doesn't want to hear your truths. So that's going to have a resounding effect on Soviet preparations for the war. It's absolutely essential to understanding how Operation Barbarossa, the German invasion of the Soviet Union, is pulled off as an intelligence ploy. And again, all of this really comes back to Stalin and the hierarchy, right? Mm-hmm. It comes back to the Kremlin. And it is there that we need to always turn to understand the full scale of Russian failure in the beginning of the war, as much as we look to it for success in the latter half, but also to the nature of the war to come, a war that may have been inevitable. Us historians don't like the word inevitable. It's not a very useful thing for us. But certainly, had they been better prepared, and that means had better leadership, you could argue that they probably wouldn't have suffered quite so much as they're about to. So a lot of this is self-inflicted, and we sometimes gloss over that in the narrative of the Second World War.
Speaking of selling them through to Stalin, you know, there was sometimes intelligence would wait hours and a whole day or days even to tell the truth because they were so nervous in case none of the last thing
Absolutely.
that it would do.
Yeah, absolutely. And Stalin, we have documents, you know, Stalin in his own hand dismissing intelligence report from, you know, institutions that he relied upon, right? So the NKVD, political intelligence, GRU, military intelligence, you know, some really fantastic intelligence networks in occupied in Europe and elsewhere. Utterly disregards them. So, you know, at the end of the day, when you're doing an analysis of this kind of nature, it's the same in any other country. You have to look at the leadership. You have to be able to look at the mechanics of the state to get that sort of, you know, full view. We do that with other countries. There is a difficulty, and the difficulty is in part documentation. The Russian state today, as well as the Soviet state during most of the 20th century, you know, doesn't really play nice with its documents, right? So while a lot of documents have come out, we're still missing a lot, and Putin's regime is not likely to assist. But then secondly, Russians, especially today, and you know, I'm ethnically Russian, I come from a Russian family, you know, there it's not true of all Russians, of course, but there is a difficulty in understanding victory. Right. On the one hand, this tremendous, almost unimaginable sacrifice and victory that the Soviet Union will achieve, and the ruthless, despotic, you know, very cruel nature of that state, both in and outside of the Soviet Union. And a lot of people struggle with that narrative. So I know because they often bark at me, right? When they hear or see me talk about that and say, how can you talk about the Great Patriotic War and then talk about rape and murder by Soviet soldiers? And of course, to me, I say, well, those are part and parcel of the same thing. It doesn't, you know, change the fact that they both happened. So that's a difficulty, right? A lot of people today have a hard time reconciling that image of Stalin as a victor against, you know, his really quite inept and often a brutally bad leadership and the tremendous cruelty of the state.
So let's talk about the invasion briefly, and of course the Battle of Stalingrad, so the Operation Barbarossa. And before I want to go into Stalingrad, I want to know because you know, as you know, they've got the race Petrograd, Leningrad, sorry, at the to the ground. But let us say if they had not gone for Stalingrad, which was you know, the one when they went, if they went to the Battle of if it would be Battle of Moscow, for example, would that have been an different outcome, or would it be the same outcome
Yeah, it's you know,
eventually?
it's of course really difficult to deal with counterfactual history. I know what you mean. Yeah, for sure. I mean, I in a you know, even though we can't really go there, counterfactuals are not what we do. I'll go there, and I'll tell you, it's impossible for me to imagine that Stalingrad, you know, is anything but the worst military mistake the Germans ever made. It's, you know, when I teach World War II history, there are, of course, lots to cover, but, you know, three main campaigns, three main turning points that I think most military and diplomatic historians would agree to: El Alamein in North Africa, Battle of Midway in the Pacific, and Stalingrad. And of those three, Stalingrad is by far the most important in a lot of ways, just by virtue of what it does to the German army in terms of its decimation. And in terms of the Soviets, in you know, coming back from a near certain defeat. So that leads to your question, which is, you know, was Stalingrad worth it? Absolutely not. I mean, the German invasion plan, you know, Barbarossa accounted for, as I'm sure you know, three broad movements, right? A north, a middle, and a south. The northern target was Leningrad, the second biggest city, modern day St. Petersburg. Extremely important, not just for its location, but for its you know, its portent to Russian culture and to politics and so on. And then Moscow as the nerve center, the government center, also very important. And then a third drive, at least initially aimed at the Caucasus, broadly defined, right? And that was principally an economically designed military
For
campaign.
oil, right? For
For oil,
resources.
yeah, and also to sever the Soviets' breadbasket, right, to cut off Ukraine and to basically steal all the food, as it were, and all the other resources. And yes, eventually drive down, as far as you can. Baku is the ultimate destination, so you have access to the Caspian, and therefore you cut off oil and gas supplies. So that's the logic of it. Where Stalingrad comes in is that even with unsuccessful sieges at both Moscow and Leningrad, Hitler makes the fateful decision to go after that one city. There's different interpretations. Some people said he did it, principally out of a stupid, arrogance because it bore the name of his rival, right? I don't think that's probably the only calculation there, even for Hitler, but certainly something to mention. Others, I think, a little bit more factually point out that it is really the last basis in that region for a main encampment of the Soviet army, right? That's kind of like the last stand of the Soviet army has withdrawn to near or in Stalingrad. And then, of course, it's on the Volga River, right? So once you control the Volga and you can get past the Volga, there's nothing basically to stop you from a conquest of the country. Potentially quite valid reasons, but not at the expense that is about to unfold. So many people therefore kick in and say, well, ultimately it is a bit of a distraction. You should have focused principally on securing that southern flank, the Caucasus and Ukraine in particular. That makes the city less important. So when the command decision comes to go to Stalingrad, it is basically sealing a fate, right, of the German army. They're now committed to a very different enterprise. They're still at Moscow and they're still at Leningrad, and it's not going terribly well, right? Contrary to their narrative, they're supposed to be in Moscow inside 4 months, and of course that doesn't happen. So in that sense, a lot of historians would say, well, that was a real distraction, and it becomes even worse when famously Hitler denies the German army there the request to withdraw when things go really horribly, horribly wrong. And that's going to seal their fate with, tremendous losses, right? Over 300,000 are taken prisoner. This is a massive army. The greatest loss of life for the Germans occurs there, right? In terms of their forces and their depletion. So in that way, it is the most significant turning point. And I could go on and on, right? It has a tremendous effect on morale and the psychology of the Soviet Union being able to put back. It speaks fundamentally to Stalin and communist narratives about the people's struggle, because the people struggled, right? This isn't just an army that defends Stalingrad. It's a hornet's nest of civilians. The city is, as I'm sure you know, the city is absolutely leveled. There's nothing worth fighting for. And again, that speaks to German callousness and arrogance. I know some military historians that would argue the biggest mistake the Germans made was not just trying to take the city, but by destroying the city, because they created perfect conditions for the resistance that follows, right? So a bunch of rubble from which you have snipers and sappers and street to street fighting. And that rendered German heavy equipment, the big focus of the German armed forces was always its air force and its tank corps. And neither of those are terribly useful in Stalingrad because you've created this rat's nest. So from start to finish, this is a disaster of German military planning. And it is, again, Stalin aside, monstrous man that he was, the stand there serves exactly that purpose, albeit at the price of millions of dead, which is to have a resolute defense of a Soviet city, drain the German army, and then launch a massive counteroffensive. So in the world of World War II, there's nothing really more important than Stalingrad, and the loss of life there is of course testament to that.
And a horrible thing, as this might be to say, Stalin was lucky that there were so many people living in the country that he could just send, next wave after wave after wave to defend Stalingrad, and in general, send soldiers to large crowd for slaughter, just send it
Absolutely.
not defend the city. And he was really lucky that there were so many people living. I don't know if that's the right word for it, but that he basically had soldiers, they couldn't retreat as well, as because if they try to retreat, and sorry, I'm putting another analogy here. I'm very soon, if they try to retreat, this they would be shot. And this is what we see
Yeah,
in
like.
the. And I'm sorry again for doing an analogy. I do love doing analogies in this podcast. So, this is what happening in Russia today as well. We discussed this in before the recording that it's hard not to see the Third Reich in Russia today because, or Soviet Union in Russia today because, soldiers have been shot if they're trying to retreat in the battle of Ukraine that is going on right now. And it's crazy that it's still happening in
It is. Yeah.
2023.
Yeah. I have a friend here who's a military man by nature and an expert on war, a very senior former commander. And he drew that out months ago that you would think that the Russians may have learned something from the Second World War in terms of strategic deployments or whatever else. But I get your parallel, and of course there are a lot of things that don't serve that analogy, but at its core, you're right. This is a commitment. It's a war of attrition like no other nation would or could fight, right? That the Soviets are prepared to grind you down by way of the expending their own lives, something that of course Americans and British and so on soldiers would never think of, right? That's the exact opposite of military doctrine. But that speaks again to the nature of the system. It speaks to the mindset of Stalin, who could not possibly care less about individual lives. Right, you know that he's famous for saying one death is a tragedy, a million is a statistic, which whether it's true or not is pretty much an epitaph for him. And in that light, the defense is something not even the Germans could have expected. So I always point out German intelligence, on the eve of Barbarossa is not by any means great. They make a lot of mistakes. The principal unit that is responsible for it is famed for making miscalculations about, the fighting spirit of the Russians and so on, the numbers and so on. But in I suppose fairness to them, they couldn't have possibly calculated for the willingness of the Soviets to spend so many lives in defense of anything, right? So even if you think they're not human, if you think they're Untermensch, it still doesn't calculate for how tenaciously this nation is prepared to fight. And you're right. What Stalin does is he finds a lot of reserves, and it's not accidental. Those reserves are pulled principally from the east, Siberia, east of the Urals, because just before the German invasion, the Soviets sign a neutrality pact with Japan, which is important. People often, skip over that little fact, but that the Japanese, of course, interested in a southward drive of their own. But what that does for the Soviet Union is that it frees up large divisions that were stationed in Manchuria and Siberia, and they are able to be redeployed to here. Something that the German intelligence units never really accounted for. They didn't have a good understanding of Soviet army size or the reservists. So they're astonished. German soldiers are astonished when they see new recruits coming in. And you hit it right on the head. There is some Hollywood movies like Enemy at the Gates and so on, which are a bit, flowery in some respects, but they show that quite well. They show the inexperienced nature of Soviet defenses, the men at the Soviet defenses, how poorly equipped they were, and how they're stationed. They're just basically cattle, as we say. They're just animals to the slaughter. And the whole idea is just simply to absorb the brunt of the German offensive, waste their resources, tire them out. That's a horrible military strategy, but it is at the core of the Soviet defense strategy throughout World War II, particularly at Stalingrad. And yeah, it looks like Putin, and his generals haven't really strayed too much from that narrative.
So let's of course talk about the German retreat, and before we do that, I want to talk about POWs, prisoners of wars, because as you know, both Germans get some Soviet prisoners of war, and of course the Soviets get a lot of German prisoners of war. But it's quite horrendous what happened on both sides, because if you, as you know, if you were a Soviet prisoner of war, Stalin looked at you as a traitor to the nation, and then you came back, you were sent to the gulags. So we are
Yeah.
not in for a good, either way, you were not in for a good time on either side if you were a POW.
Absolutely. I mean, I think I never want to speak out of turn, but It is, if I'm not mistaken, the highest or one of the highest mortality rates in military calculations in the Second World War is to be a Soviet prisoner of Germany or a German prisoner of the Soviet Union. And it speaks fundamentally to the bloodlust between the two. This is a unique war. I always teach about, World War II in effect as separate wars, meaning that, how the Allies fight it, not that it's pleasant ever there either, Western Allies, but they're exposed to a very different kind of war than the Soviet Union is. And that's going to be critical, right? This is ingrained in the Soviet mentality, even modern day Russia. This is a war of blood. This is a war of race. This is an existential war. So the brutality that is shown by first Germans to the Soviets is more than echoed by the Soviets to the Germans when the tides turn of war. And I think that, speaks fundamentally to the nature of World War II there. If I'm not mistaken, in the first 2 weeks of the German invasion, there's already near a million dead and a million missing amongst the Red Army, which are losses that are, what, five times what the Americans lose in the entire course of the Second World War, right? So that's a little factoid that speaks again fundamentally to the nature of the war. And most of those prisoners are dead within a few weeks, if I'm not mistaken. Most Russian prisoners taken by the Germans in the first few weeks of Barbarossa have an extraordinary mortality rate. They're amongst the first to be subjected to, to the death camps, right? Again, we often skip that discussion over, but a lot of the same brutalities that are inflicted upon Jewish people and the Roma and so on, they're also reserved for Soviet prisoners of war. I've lived in and worked in those camps, especially in Germany, and taught there, and it's extremely well documented. There's separate camps, fundamentally in places like Bergen-Belsen or Sachsenhausen, where there were, unique provisions just for Soviet soldiers. So the mortality rate is staggering. And of course, what it does is, even if they don't know the numbers, the Soviets are well aware of what's happening. So they're going to unleash hell when the tides turn, and they're going to be equally as vicious. So if I'm not, again, not mistaken, I think it's like a 70%, casualty rates amongst prisoners of war if you're taken by the Russians at the end. And that kind of brutality is sadly the norm in that Eastern Front, right? This is hell on earth. Not that war was fun anywhere else. And that's evident right from the get-go, right from the very beginning. But again, I often say, well, what would you expect, from the Nazis? I mean, after all, this is the same, invasion, the same army that unleashes Einsatzgruppen and specific killing units to destroy civilian populations, right? This is a war of blood. And in their mind, many Germans' minds, the Slavic peoples in general, but particularly Russians, Ukrainians, communists, they were the lowest of the low. They were subhuman. So, we have legendary tales of mass executions of not just civilians, but of soldiers. The raising, of course, of entire countries. How many tens of thousands of towns and villages were destroyed in a way that the Germans didn't do it in the Western areas of Europe, right? As brutal as their occupation was. So in that light, the loss of life amongst prisoners of war is sadly to be expected, right? They are nothing more than waste. And the Germans start it and the Russians finish it in a very similar fashion.
So, but I see not all the Soviet POWs died initially. Some were sent and used as soldiers for the fighting for the German side as well in Greece and on the Western Front, I believe.
Yeah, there are. I mean, there are a lot of defections. They actually occur the other way too, right? We often forget that some, especially non-German allies of the Nazis, defected, right? Some, people from Polish and other countries that had signed up with the Nazis actually were important to try to give intelligence in advance of the invasion. But yeah, you certainly have a number of people. There are differing estimates on it, of course, and different interpretations. But in places like Poland and in the Ukraine, some people signed up with the Nazis and then others defected to the Nazis. There were also some expatriates, Russians, people that had fled the Bolshevik Revolution, identified as White Russian, living throughout many of Europe's countries, and they signed up, for it as well. You have, of course, some Finns, you have Frenchmen. It shocks people that there is quite a large international component,
There
not
wasn't even a
necessarily.
Scandinavian unit
Yeah,
as prior to
absolutely, and
this.
not necessarily all deployed in the Eastern Front, but. Tens of thousands and sometimes far more than that signed up for the Nazis because they appeared to be victorious. And also, they were speaking a language in their virulent anti-Semitism and anti-communist perspectives that a lot of people liked, right? Hating Jewish people and hating communists was not unique to Germany. So, yeah, there were people. And of course, that is not just a historical fact, but it's something that isn't part of the modern narrative. Putin has gone out of his way to talk about Ukraine as being complicit with Nazi invasion, right? He brings up Stefan Bandera, the famous, Ukrainian leader, nationalist who supported, the Nazis to a large degree. And that's why he gets away with these kind of comments that Ukraine is full of fascists and so on. Utter nonsense in the modern day reality of it. But it has long lasting effect because Putin certainly remembers, and I think a lot of Russians do, whether they're right about it or not. They remember German soldiers being welcomed into Ukrainian towns, right? There's images of girls, throwing flowers at them and breaking bread with them and so on. Those are real. I think that's got to be said, but they're distortive, right? Because the Germans quickly massacre them. And there's, fierce resistance that arises in places like Ukraine to the Germans, because the Germans are stupid enough to make this a blood war instead of making it a military campaign. First and foremost, they begin their extermination and their brutality right away. So yeah, there are people that went over to the other side. I've actually interviewed some of them in the course of my life. Many of them will tell you the same thing, that they didn't know what else to do, that they were simply trying to survive. That's quite possible. They may have been ideologically inclined and so on, but I the reason I don't make so much out of it is because, of course, they're a relatively small number compared to those that stay and fight. And in the Russian experience, when you're talking about 30 million dead, the sacrifice of the people who fight against Nazism is more important.
So of course, I thought about how the battle turned around after Stalingrad, because as you know, that is kind of the turning point, at least on the Eastern Front of the war. But as you know, the Russians, they had a scorched earth policy. So when the Red Germans retreated, it wasn't only bad for them, right? It was also, but what was it like for the Soviet as well, going back through this scorched earth that they themselves set fire on a while earlier?
Yeah, it's horrific. It's absolutely horrific. And again, the Germans did not anticipate that. Why is a good question, because of course this was a time-honored tradition in Russian military strategy. They did a very similar thing when Napoleon invaded in 1812, and again in World War One. So yeah, that is the defensive mentality of the Soviets. They use that throughout the war, right? Is to withdraw from an area, taking full advantage of the size of their country, baiting the adversary, in this case the Germans, further in, exposing their lines of communication and support, dragging them further and further, and making them vulnerable. And then fighting in basically in different lines, right? There's the defensive military strategy. You fight here, and then you have a series of lines moving backwards. Each one designed not necessarily to withhold the enemy, but to tire the enemy, right? To make them exhausted, and that had tremendous success. But of course, you have to be willing to pay the price. That kind of strategy entails burning your land to the ground. In the case of the Second World War, it also requires something that has not really ever been done before, certainly not on the scale, which is to move everything that's worth keeping, industrial infrastructure, resources, you name it, withdrawing it from the area of invasion and occupation and reestablishing it behind safer lines, which is precisely what the Soviets do. So remarkably, and I don't think anybody, including the Soviets, knew that they would be able to pull that off, but that's exactly what they did. I always tell my students it's the rough equivalent of taking everything from where we live here in southern Ontario and transplanting it back in Manitoba, right? The distance of 1,000 kilometers away, right? Picking up rail lines and factories and reassembling it. It's a remarkable moment, and it's precisely because of that that the Soviets are able to, be like a phoenix from the ashes, right? They come back from defeat because they've managed to save so much of their industry in Western Russia. Now, when they push back out, the consequences, of course, they see barren fields that haven't been properly, tilled during German occupation, mass starvation, of course. And so it is a very difficult enterprise. The Soviets move much quicker in a lot of ways. And of course, a lot of that industrial and even agricultural infrastructure has shifted to other parts of the Soviet state, right? So they have some capacity to feed their men. But I'll also point out, listen, if you get into the weeds of World War II and you study the Soviet soldier, your average, rifleman, for example, they are remarkable characters, right? They are tough guys in the classic sense of the word. They travel lightly, for the most part. They have very few provisions. They don't eat very much. They don't drink very much. It's sort of staples, right? It's
To
black
compare
bread.
that kind of like camel, like.
Like these guys are these are remarkable. They live on kasha, the grain cereal, if you like, and chai tea, and they keep moving. So in that light, the mass destruction that was theirs to begin, and then Germans, of course, by virtue of their occupation, it does have an effect. But the Soviet Union has done something unbelievably remarkable and frankly unprecedented, which is to rebuild its war effort in the midst of almost certain defeat, right? And that's from an industrial as well as an agricultural perspective. That's where some people sing the praises of Stalin. I would never do that personally, but I'd sing the praises of the Soviet people, right? And their willingness and tenacity to fight and then to rebuild. But yeah, you're right. By the time they start marching through those places are in many cases barren.
Now, something, of course, that is essential, and as a I'm pretty sure it's not taught in Russian schools today when this comes to mind, and I'm sure you know what I'm talking about now, is the Allied aid that happened during the taking back territory after Stalin coming back. So let's talk a little bit about the essential, because it was quite essential to Soviet victory as well. That, of course, like you said, it's not taught in Soviet schools today. That's kind of forgotten about the
Yeah, I
Allied
mean,
aid to Soviet Union.
it was which is it's such a great question because it's something that is really neglected. I talk about it a lot whenever I can because it's an important narrative. It's an essential narrative. Beginning in October of 1941, so just a few months after the German invasion, the Roosevelt administration extends Lend-Lease, right, the very famous economic and military program, to the Soviet Union. It's already been enacted for China and for the United Kingdom, for Canada as well. And it is basically, it's a wonderfully illegal thing, right? It's technically illegal under neutrality acts in the United States. For the government to deal with protagonists of any sort. But because Roosevelt is Roosevelt, he is prepared to challenge his own laws. And Lend-Lease does what it says. It's lending or leasing military equipment. It's kind of, when you get right down to it, it's basically the Americans preparing to give you bullets with the request that eventually you give them back, as if you're going to go and retrieve them from enemy bodies and sort of, give them back to you. Now, there are economic stipulations. You got to pay back money and so on. But what it does for the Soviet Union is remarkable. By the end of the war, it's about $11 billion, which is, not nearly as much as other countries, but still a lot. What's
Still a
really
lot if you don't have $11 million.
It's there you go. It's a lot more than you think if you're in the midst of defeat and you don't have a very vibrant economy to begin with. But the real kicker isn't just Lend-Lease itself. That lasts throughout the war technically, because by 1943, certainly Soviet factories have, sort of come back, right, with that movement of raw materials and personnel and equipment. So they're able to manufacture a lot of the stuff that they couldn't. So really the big critical point is between late 1941 and sort of mid 1943, a good chunk of the war. And it's there where the Americans end up giving them ridiculous numbers. I think it's 10,000 tanks, if I'm not mistaken. And I read once it's something like 700,000 military vehicles, like trucks and equipment. That's a monstrous sum, not to mention other military equipment and money itself. So the reason it's so important is we have documents of Stalin himself, like the boss, commenting particularly at some of the peace conference, some of the conferences that unfolded in World War II, making public comments about how grateful he is to the United States, making private comments to the Politburo and others, how they couldn't have won without them. And then that's echoed by guys like Nikita Khrushchev, right? His eventual successor, who was at Stalingrad, amongst other places. And he said, listen, in the first stages of the war, we were done if it was not for lend-lease. So this isn't abstract. It's not sort of, mixing the numbers and having different interpretations. But that 2-year period, lend-lease is really important to the Soviet state. We don't know if they could have survived, might have survived without it. That's a hypothetical. But it is something that needs to be addressed. And of course, the reason it's not, you and I both know, right? That's not a good narrative for Stalin and victory. That's certainly not something the communists ever want to admit, particularly as the Cold War dawns in 1945 moving forward. And Russians today, they don't want to talk about it or think about it because it's undermines this narrative of the great patriotic struggle and that sense of we did it alone, which to some degree they're entitled to. I'm the first to acknowledge the sacrifice of the Soviet Union and its peoples has no equal. But that doesn't make for good history, right? We have to look at those little important factoids, and lend-lease is critical. And then, yeah, as I think you alluded to, they get also benefits, if you like, by virtue of Western political leaders, Churchill and Roosevelt in particular. And the way the end of the war comes about, like there's a lot of devil in the details, right? As to how that war progresses and precisely where the war is going to end. Ultimately, what Roosevelt called spheres of influence, a very loose idea, is borne by the armies themselves, right? So it's all a question of how fast and how far your army can get. So, in the absence of any sort of concrete plans or a possibility of something different, that favors the Soviets because, of course, the Soviets are, in a headlong rush to get as far and as fast as they can, including to Berlin and potentially beyond. And sometimes people say, well, that we can't prove that. We can prove that pretty easily. In 1945, Stalin met Averell Harriman, a famous American diplomat who spoke fluent Russian. And Harriman said to him, Comrade Stalin, congratulations on making it to Berlin. And without hesitation, Stalin said, Tsar Alexander made it to Paris. In reference to 1812. So I think there's little doubt that Stalin intended on getting as fast and as far as he can, in part for selfish reasons, gaining territory and ideological conformity and all that stuff, but also in the sense of making some sense of repayment to the Soviet Union, right? Their loss is so high, their cost so great that to him, there was a fundamental requirement to grab as much as possible at any cost, including, horrible, horrible damage inflicted upon Eastern Europe as the Soviets come.
I don't try to look it up, but I remember reading Hitler and Stalin a while last year, where there was a joke. I don't remember when this was, but where Soviet I don't remember exactly how it goes, but where a Soviet soldier passes a German soldier. And they don't know if he's either Germans. They say something, but they don't know if he's either German or Soviet soldier. I learned that line.
But they're in effect the same, right? Is that what you're saying? Yeah, I mean, listen, from a vantage point of being, many people in Eastern Europe, Poles and others, there's not much of a difference. And Russians do not like to talk about this because it undermines that narrative, right, of victory and of liberation. I just argue that you can have two things at the same time. You can be victorious and a liberator. in many respects, and a great soldier, and all of that sort of stuff, but still inflict an awful lot of suffering and damage in the process. But yeah, that is precisely what happens. And again, I'm the first to acknowledge, particularly when you come to some of the atrocities that the Red Army will commit on its way into Germany. It's never to validate it. I would never try, and nobody should try to, justify it or make sense of it or anything like that. But putting it in a context, I think you can understand, right, why anybody would do the stuff that the Red Army is going to do. It's in part indoctrination. It's in part the orders that they've been given by their commanders, by apparatchiks, bureaucrats, and leaders all the way up to Stalin. And it's also revenge, for the loss of life that has been like no other in the history of humanity. Don't forget that some of these Russian soldiers weren't fully aware that their families were alive. Right, that they had witnessed, one in four, I think, is the average, right? So, in a group of four men, one's dead every day. That is, again, no justification for rape and murder and brutality, but I think any objective observer could see, in the chaos that is World War II, that is unfortunately a very natural and human response, right? And again, I would not justify it. I don't think anybody should, but we do need to explain to some degree the context in which it happened.
We are, of course, going to come back to the rape and the atrocities committed by soldiers, Soviet soldiers, very soon. But I want to talk about the Soviet invasion of Poland right now. As you know, not Ludendorff, that was the first one, the Ribbentrop-Molotov line, as you know, when in 1939 was established, but it later broke in under Operation Barbarossa. But so let's talk about taking back not just the Ribbentrop line, but Poland as a whole.
Well, Poland had always been, of course, problematic from the Soviet perspective, right? Going way back into history, the whole idea of Poland as an agitator, right? Poland as a kingdom, the Lithuanian-Polish kingdom had been trouble for Russia. And then, of course, in a much more modern incarnation, Poland was reconstituted in part out of the Russian Empire, right? The ancient kingdom of Poland is an independent state. So, that has the sort of backdrop for Stalin's decision to make a deal with Germany on the eve of World War II, the von Ribbentrop-Molotov Pact, Nazi-Soviet Pact. And I always think it's important to point out the why part, right? There are different motivations, but the Soviets engage in this principally to, yes, of course, gain territory and spread their ideology, but principally it's out of a mortal fear. That's what I mentioned to you earlier. This is a deeply insecure state. It's been invaded through the Western Corridor repeatedly. And so for them, any amount of space between the West, broadly defined, and the Russian heartland is important. And that's the paradox of Russia. For the biggest country in the world, most of the vital stuff is very close to Europe, right? It's, much closer than the rest. So, it was a natural strategic design on their part. It was vicious, and it was also designed in part to buy time, right? We often forget that Stalin wasn't entirely stupid. He understood that a war with Germany was quite likely, but he wanted it on his terms. So I think most Soviet historians would agree that in addition to buying space, the von Ribbentrop-Molotov Pact was designed to buy time so that the Soviet army could rehabilitate, especially after the purges, right, which we talked about earlier, retrain, reformulate the army, get it ready for action. I think there's little debate today that Stalin had invasion plans for Germany. It's just that the Germans beat them to it, right? So this both sides kind of anticipated the war, and in that light, Poland became the natural dividing place. Neither Germany or Russia respected or acknowledged Polish independence. So, of course, as you know, that line was supposed to be roughly in half, but just after the German invasion, September 1st, 1939. The Soviets will invade September 17th. So 2 weeks later, they come in from the east, which is an absolute atrocity, a brutal act in so many ways, a betrayal of, Poland and the Soviet Union had fought a border war in the early 1920s. They didn't like each other. But there was still this sense of a Slavic camaraderie or whatever for some people. And of course, many Poles, when the Germans invaded, went east, right? Thinking that they might get some sort of, respite or aid from the Soviet Union, only to be confronted with a Soviet invasion. And then, although the line changes, right, the central government of Poland becomes, German controlled, that's because the Germans and the Soviets make deals as the invasion unfolds. So the Soviets take, for example, Lithuania as part of their, prizes from the war. They invade Finland, as you know, and then the Germans take more Poland. But the reason it's so important is because Stalin's approach is made very clear. We don't have to wait until 1944, 45, when the Soviet army is advancing in Poland to know what they're going to do. We see it right away in 1940. And most famously, as I'm sure you're well aware of, is Katyn, right? The massacre of thousands of Polish officers. Originally blamed on the Nazis, but proved forensically, as well as through documents many years later, to be the act of the NKVD and Russian military. So, so much for your Slavic Brotherhood, right? The Russians have no intention of allowing for an independent Poland as early as 1939. They don't need to wait. And that does speak volumes about their approach come later in the war. So that approach later in the war is itself a monstrous example. It is debated. I gather you're referring to, in particular, the Siege of Warsaw, as they push across the border. It is debated, right? So I wouldn't be a very good historian if I sort of gave you one narrative only. Some non-Russian historians have argued that the Russians didn't launch an assault to save the Polish Home Army operating in Warsaw. Or, of course, Jewish people in the infamous ghetto when they rise up in advance of the Red Army coming. And the reason that they didn't do it is, in a conventional narrative, it's because Stalin wanted to exhaust Polish independence, wanted to have as many Poles killed as possible before his own army came in with the intention of occupying it ruthlessly. That's always an equation, right? We are talking about Stalin. So, right off of the bat, it's very likely that Stalin had no respect and regard for those people, couldn't care less. Why would he? He spent millions of his own soldiers fighting this war. It's not like all of a sudden he's going to care about, Polish Jews or the Home Army. So that is in part true, but there is another narrative, and some military historians would argue it made sense to not invade Warsaw, to not attack Warsaw, at least not initially. And the sense for that is that there was the Red Army was still exposed to a reasonably capable German army in Pomerania in the in the north, right, to the north of Warsaw in German and Polish territory, and that it needed to consolidate before it could move forward, right? And that was actually the advice of Chukov and others, who said, we got to wait. We're going to expose ourselves if we don't. And those same historians would bring up that there were relief attempts. There were a couple of albeit small scale advances by the Red Army during that 6 month, hiatus or waiting period, and also air relief, right? They tried to drop supplies and so on. So I mean, personally, I think the first is likely truer, right? I can't imagine that Stalin really cared at all about, Polish citizens or the defense of Warsaw. I think Soviet intelligence made it clear that the German defenses there were stronger than anticipated. So from a Russian perspective, it made sense to wait it out. And the suffering of Polish people was never a primary concern. Why would you think it would be, right, from this guy and from this nation? But I think we also need to consider that it's not just that heartlessness and callousness, it's also this strategic concern. Don't forget, Russian forces repeatedly, this needs to be said, from the gates of Stalingrad and Moscow and eventually Leningrad, as they push back, Soviet strategy was always this defensive a cycle, right? We have lines of defense. We exhaust the enemy as they come to it. We spend a great deal of life, but ultimately we drain our foe. And then they launch counteroffensives. So the history of World War II for the Soviets is always a series of counteroffensives, even when they weren't really capable of launching them. Stalin was famous for launching counteroffensives, even at Stalingrad and at Moscow. With small numbers, relatively small numbers, right? And that was designed to catch the enemy off guard, keep them, at bay. So by the time you reach Warsaw, the principal commanders, Korniev, who leads the Ukrainian front, and Zhukov in command of the Belarusian front, the two major armies of the Soviet Red
If
Army.
I may interrupt you for a second, I think it's also worth mentioning, I believe it was Warsaw that the Nazis burned to the ground before retreating.
Of course. So, from their perspectives, you and again, I'm not apologizing, I'm not justifying anything, but their first job is to think about their victory, right? They are in a race to Berlin, ordered by the boss, and at the end of a tremendous period of suffering for their people, they are not stopping to consider individual countries or the lives of foreigners. That's just not their top priority. But they are concerned about overexposing themselves. So even with their huge numbers, right, by this point, I think it's what, 7 million in under gun, like 7 million Russian soldiers in the Red Army that are actual fighting with reservists. That will eventually pump it up to nearly 12 million, the biggest army the world has ever seen. But there's still dangers and setbacks, and that's because the history until that date in the Second World War was precisely that. The Soviets advanced, but then would get pushed back, right? Kursk is a good example, right? The famous tank battle at Kursk, which is ultimately a Soviet victory. In the initial parts, it's a German counteroffensive, and then the Russians launch an attack and they get beat. They lost 600,000 men in counteroffenses in that area. So, if you reach Warsaw, you're pretty excited about the potential for victory. You're almost certain it's at hand, but you still don't want to expose your soldiers. So that has to at least come into the narrative, even though I, having said all that, would concede that it was very likely more the case of Stalin wanting to exhaust any resistance in Poland, right? A country which he despised at the end of the day, and which he saw as absolutely integral to the long-term security of the Soviet state.
So something that I feel is kind of overlooked, but it's starting to get more attention now, I think, with the recent Bloodlands by Timothy Snyder and, of course, the Iron Curtain. They are mentioned quite a lot. And I think you know what I'm referring to right now is the partisan group, Armia Krajowa. So let's talk about them a little bit under German occupation before we move in to the way they were treated by Soviet soldiers
I
during the
mean,
invasion.
part of I teach a fair amount about partisans, in part out of interest, and partisans generally in the whole narrative of the Second World War. They're often undersung, right? The impact and importance of partisan movements everywhere. They're very different, as you know, right? I mean, there's so many different partisan groups, different sizes, shapes, different ideologies, and so on. Resistance in Poland throughout the war was really quite extraordinary. It was responsible for a great deal of important intelligence information that fed the West, intelligence about German military and industrial plants, particularly heavy water, development of atomic bomb, that kind of stuff. And also really important because pound for pound, Poland suffers more than any country in the Second World War in terms of the loss of life, right? I think it's 1 in 3 Poles, which is even higher than in the Soviet Union, which is monstrous. So you can't begin a discussion about the Home Army or about any resistance, Jewish resistance too, without this idea of heroism, right? And I know people get uncomfortable with that because then you're down this rabbit hole of was everybody, nice and were they all in agreement with ideas that we share today? That's not really the domain of a historian in so many different ways. So, what we really have to go down to is that this was a home army that was under ruthless occupation from 1939, from the very beginning to the war to the very end of the war. And that so many Poles, Gentiles as much as Jews, had perished. Yes, this is the scene of extermination camps, and it is the scene of the highest proportion of Jewish loss of life, and those things are, incredibly important, should never be forgotten. It's just there's no but either. It's just that also we want to point out that the ruthlessness of German occupation extended beyond Jewishness. They were ruthless towards, Gentiles as well. Maybe less so in the sense of extermination and the ghettos and so on. But that narrative is important because it does speak to Poland today, and it speaks to a lot of Poles. I know an awful lot of Polish, people here in Canada and elsewhere, and they do feel that that's a neglected narrative, right? In World War II, and understandably, because they were brutalized by the Nazis in so many ways, forced labor, executions, of course. And yet still found the ability, the resolve to fight in absolutely unimaginable conditions. I couldn't imagine being a member of a partisan group anywhere, frankly. I don't know that I'd have the courage to operate as one. But particularly in places like besieged, occupied Poland, where German, bureaucracy was absolute. They were, had ruthless efficiency in almost every single Polish city and town. In that light, the Home Army is really remarkable. It really is, and its tenacity to fight. And then, yes, of course, it should feel betrayed because it was betrayed. I mean, there's no two ways about it. Even if you want to justify why the Russians don't come into Warsaw faster than they do, the reality is that they had this expectation, right? Knowing the Red Army would come, that at least they'd beat the Nazis. And of course, they are bled to death in places like Warsaw and elsewhere. And it's no consolation, absolutely. But that doesn't necessarily negate the importance that they had throughout the war. They kept the Germans at bay in a lot of places. The very fact that they're able to operate in Warsaw, as late as 1944 is really extraordinary, right? That you think about the ruthless brutality and efficiency of the Nazis, and here in the capital city of Poland, they still didn't have full control. That is a testament. That's a feather in the cap to the Home Army. When it comes to the Russians, they didn't know it, of course. The Home Army couldn't have known it, but the Russians had already demonstrated, the Soviet army had already demonstrated its own ruthlessness to partisans. It had formally liquidated large numbers of partisans in Ukraine and Belarus who fought
I think
against
it's
them.
also worth mentioning, it wasn't quite legal to be a partisan group either.
Well, that's right. Even if they were endorsed or, to some degree authorized by the Red Army, as was the case in Ukraine and Belarus, they became likely enemies, right? If I'm the Red Army marching into town, the last thing I'm really want to do is to have to deal with 20, 30,000 members of a Ukrainian independence movement, who calls itself partisans and got rid of the Nazis, but could very easily turn its guns on me. So in that case, Stalin made it abundantly clear where not all partisans, but how most partisans were to be treated, right? They were tolerated by the Red Army. There are some, legendary cases of them operating alongside the Red Army in places like Belarus and Ukraine. But when it comes to Poland, that's a different calculation. These are not Russians. They're not Soviet citizens. And of course, they're members of a nation which was fundamentally hostile to the Soviet Union. So Stalin could care less about them. And their fate, to a large degree, is sealed. But last but not least, we also have to point out, as many Poles do, that this is a betrayal, not just from the Russian side, but also from the Western Allied side. Guys like like Churchill, right, had to some degree sealed their fate during the famous percentages agreement when he meets with Stalin in Moscow in 1944, and rather infamously jots down on a serviette, on a napkin, jots down the percentages of Eastern European countries that the British are prepared to entertain occupation by Soviet forces. So that is a betrayal of the free Poles, right? This London Poles, as they're called, the free London, free Polish movement operating in London, who wanted to come back as the legitimate government of that state. And of course, most Poles, right to this day, feel that that was a bitter betrayal at Yalta, principally, a bitter betrayal of Polish independence. And there's a great argument for that, right? I think there's little doubt.
I think it's fair to say, as you know, after World War II, Hitler's talked a lot about the stab in the back of logic. But I think if it's fair to say that anyone by any war has been truly stabbed in the back, it's
Yeah,
Poland.
absolutely.
I think
Absolutely.
they're one of those who can barely say that they've been stabbed in the back.
And I would never disagree with that. I think that's pretty strong case that this was a very conscious decision by particularly Churchill. There is a but, and it needs to be said as usual. I've got a but for you, but and the but is that very sadly for Poland, I don't know that anything else could have happened. And by that I mean, the London Poles notwithstanding, and the Home Army fighting on their behalf. The reality was that the only way by 1944 45 to change the outcome into Poland would have been to extend the war against the Soviet Union, something that the Allies were not prepared to do politically or militarily or economically, right? That's how ultimate this gamble is. So when Poles rightly point out that they were betrayed, the only difficulty is to say, well, what would you have expected? Because I can't imagine anything short of a massive military campaign by the Americans and the British against the Soviets, which is just not going to happen. There's no way it's going to happen in that moment. That would have been the only thing to dislodge them. And that's because the Soviets had no intention whatsoever of leaving Poland. That's not a negotiating. It never appears in the Russian mindset to negotiate on Poland. You might be able to negotiate on Greece or Turkey or Iran, all places which after World War II are somewhat divided between Western and Soviet interests. Maybe on Austria, maybe on Finland. Those are sort of peripheral areas for the Soviet army and for Stalin, not Poland. Poland is the corridor through which Russia has been, historically invaded. It's the weak link. It's that, but it's the worst geographical, position in history, sandwiched between two nightmare neighbors. Can you imagine a worse place to be, right? So
Absolutely.
in that light, the Soviets have no intention of entertaining an independent Poland, even if Stalin frequently said that they would, right? You know that he said at Yalta, he makes some sort of quip, Stalin's attempt at humor, and he's talking about the London Poles, and he says, well, you can send them back. Right, meaning that we'll entertain a, a democratic government, or we'll see what happens. You know that he would have
I mean,
shot
they
them.
did attempt eventually in the beginning, they did attempt sort of democracy, if you
Maybe,
can call it.
But I wouldn't. I wouldn't hesitate because absent from that experimentation is any genuine intent on the part of Moscow, and the fact that Stalin's cronies, the communist Poles based in Lublin, didn't want the London Poles to come back. They didn't entertain an independent country, and the London Poles, by and large, understand that that's their death sentence if they go back. All of which, as I think, absolutely true, even though we don't know for sure, because it's a similar fate that awaited many people in other occupied countries, right? Romania, Bulgaria, even Czechoslovakia. So, with that in mind, the sad and cruel reality is that while other things may have been negotiable as the war comes to an end, Poland is not among them, not from a Soviet perspective.
You mentioned toleration of Armia Krajowa partisans, but you also do have stories where they shoot them on sight, or even after the war, or and during, if you find some a person that looks suspicious, he would just get grabbed right off the street. And you have the story of a father working this child, I think, and he just grabbed off the street in front of his child and killed because he, I think he suppose I'm not sure if he was a partisan or not, but he.
Yeah, it
Because I
doesn't matter.
believed he was a partisan,
Yeah. And again, it's not to be at all inhuman about what you're saying. Quite the opposite. That is such a normal facet of World War II, right? It's unimaginable to our generations today, especially living in nice democracies, but that was the reality. It was the reality in 1939 when Germans came in and they sent you off to a camp or forced you into slave labor or shot you on the street. There is no justice. There's at the very best a facsimile of it. There's like kangaroo courts that descend, and that was true. That's a Polish narrative. That's a global narrative, right? It's the Japanese do the same thing to Chinese nationals and so on and so forth, Russians to everybody else as well. So that sort of brutality, that callousness is the hallmark of the Second World War. And that's where a lot of certainly my students of, in their early 20s find it so unimaginable because it's just so, so brutal and so random. But yeah, that's exactly what happened. If you were a suspect, and this is true in Norway, it was true, if you were suspected of being a Norwegian partisan, It's not like they really cared for evidence. It's not like they were gonna, try you in a court in Oslo. They're gonna, at very least, they're gonna harass you, torture you, beat you for a confession, and then kill you, right? Like that's the modus operandi of German intelligence, the Gestapo, Geheimstaatspolizei, and the Schutzstaffel, and any number one of these horrendous agencies. And very similar on the other side, right? The Soviets exercised the exact same approach throughout throughout World War II.
So we mentioned it a little bit earlier, but we have to take some time to talk about the mass atrocities committed by Soviet troops, and not just the looting, but also the mass rape, because some women were mass gang raped by soldiers, though it was illegal. They were as horrible as it was tolerated by you could be at worst jailed for a few days if you were caught. But it was mass rapes going on the invasion by the Soviet soldiers.
Absolutely. And again, these are unspeakable crimes, but we need to speak about them because they're a complete narrative. They at least help complete our narratives of the Second World War. And you hit it on the head, right? The Soviets view these, I mean, legally speaking, you weren't supposed to do that. There were edicts from military commanders that said, don't do that. But they were not at all enforced. And frankly, they were few and far between relative to what the Soviet army was doing in terms of its advance. There's a lot of evidence to suggest that the Red Army, of course, the Germans did that, right? The German armies raped and brutalized women throughout the Soviet Union as they swept through. We can't forget that narrative. It's not, again, a justification for what happens coming the other way. But that was burned into the Soviet mentality, right? That these, monsters had murdered millions of our people, raped and brutalized others. And it seemed to be fair game. And again, I am really got to be clear about this, right? It's important for historians to set the context, not to justify anything or explain it the way, explained it away. But that context is important. Most of these men in the Soviet army were between 17 and 21 years old, relatively young. Many of them, as particularly in the advance, were from there was no setup in the Soviet army to have ethnic divisions. So that's a myth, right? Soviet armies were highly integrated, except for a few units, which were, so like the Tatars out of Crimea. Most were integrated, so they were multi-ethnic, multi-disciplinary. And of course, you're talking about 150 odd ethnic minorities in Russia and languages and so on. So the reason I bring that up is because many of them came from remote places. Where one could argue, and I've read these accounts, I'm not saying I would do it myself, but some people say, well, they're terribly uneducated from different parts of largely rural places, now subject to incredible trauma. In some cases, their homes destroyed, and in many cases, their own women and children murdered or raped or killed. And again, not to justify, but you can see that picture, right? As they move forward of revenge, absolutely. And this concept being very vulnerable to both communist propaganda and by virtue of their lack of education, to the idea that this is the spoils of war, right? This is what you do when you're a soldier who's victorious. After all, this stuff has happened throughout history. It's not the first time that you see mass rape and conquest. So in the same way that they, pillaged and stole things, they also see rape as a kind of extension of that. And of course, that is fundamentally brutal and wrong on so many different levels. But commanders are not prepared to dissuade from that. The commanders shared a lot of convictions. The Soviet army, was very close in a lot of ways. Commanders who fought were revered by their boys. They're actually called dad. Right, the Russian word is translates into dad or father. So if your commander is not telling you, to stop, then you think it's part and parcel. And as a lot of psychologists would weigh in, most of the Russian atrocities are driven not by sexual desire but by violence. Right, these are crimes of violence, as rape always is, and it's in that sense a kind of revenge factor. There are excellent accounts of what the Soviets do when they reach Germany in particular. And as I'm sure you know, there's an estimated, a reported or documented to some degree, approximately 2 million rapes, which is staggering, just on the approach to Berlin. So you could probably double or triple that in terms of all the lack of evidence or testimony or recount that we have. And that's why, you know, one of my favorite books of all time is A Woman in Berlin, right? Written by Anonymous, which is just a horrific and harrowing account of a woman, a journalist in Berlin. Now we assume that's her identity. It's still contested. You know, and it's a very curious narrative to show how the Russians did it, you know, what their sort of the politics, there was a politic to it in terms of how German women tried to survive. It's really a testament to those women and their strength, you know, to withhandle not only the defeat of their nation at war and the emasculation of their men, right? Their men had been defeated. But their survival is remarkable. It's another narrative of the Second World War that needs to be accounted for. And in no way does it change or justify Soviet, you know, horrors. But yeah, approximately 2 million women there. I would hazard a guess that millions more on the path, including Ukrainians and Poles and others. This is a huge army that has suffered tremendously and is defending a nation which has bled very nearly to death. So there's no restraint. Even Stalin famously quipped, right, I think it's his only comment on rape in the war, where he says, "You actually expect me to stop them from having their fun," something of that,
I was
right?
going to add that.
Yeah. So I mean, you know, this is not, it's just not a priority. And again, that's not my interpretation, but from a military and political perspective, why on earth would Stalin care about what a few soldiers do? After what they faced and what they're intending to do. And of course, that's just another, you know, horribly callous and inhuman dimension of the Second World War.
And of course, if your age didn't even matter, if all elder women were raped, as
Didn't matter.
well as the teenagers, underage girls, I'm sure. It didn't matter the age. If you were a communist wife, it
No,
didn't matter.
not at all. And that's where, again, a lot of experts, you know, I'm no psychologist for certain, but a lot of them would say, well, that was the sort of another illustration of how these were acts of violence and also of desperation, in many cases of frustration. You know, it's not to legitimize the perpetrator under any circumstances. As I said, A Woman in Berlin does a really artful job of describing how a lot of German women, there was a politic to it, right? They would go for commanders if they were gonna, you know, have to be in these situations, if they were gonna get raped. You know, many of them tried to get commanders who were generally more powerful and would stop mass rape from happening. So they would be raped by one man as opposed to dozens. There were horrific accounts of a lot of German and other women scarring themselves to try to look, you know, less attractive, if you like, I suppose that's a calculation. But at the end of the day, you know, this is an army which is unstoppable in more than just the military means. There is nothing to prevent them from these kind of atrocities. Russians are innately uncomfortable with these conversations. I know I've been barked at by many people who say you can't talk about that, you know, as we're narrating the Great Patriotic War. And I say that's nonsense. You know, what kind of a historian would I or anybody be if they sort of didn't tell you? That's like saying, you know, the Russians win World War II, and I'm not going to tell you about their occupation of Eastern Europe for the next 4 decades, right? It's illogical. So I think, yes, this is a great narrative of Russian victory, Russian Soviet victory, Soviet sacrifice, and so on. But it is absolutely imperative to account for their brutality. And it's not just the rape of women. There's enslavement of people. There, you know, the concentration camps that are liberated. Some of them are put into service immediately for the NKVD, and in many cases, the prisoners who were there under the Nazis remain prisoners under the Soviets. There is, you know, mass deportations that occur. There is random executions of people just because they were, you know, alleged to be partisans, whether it's Polish or Ukrainian or so on. We need to talk about this, and I think there's no better time than today, where Russia, of course, suffers from a collective delusion led by their leader. who is, by the way, and importantly, fascinated with World War II. We shouldn't forget that. Putin, I remember a few years ago doing some media when Putin gave this ridiculously long and bizarre speech about how Poland started the Second World War. And now, of course, in retrospect, you can see how driven this man is by these narratives of how, Eastern Europe has betrayed him, or the historical identity of Ukraine and Poland are questionable, and so on. So today, many Russians have no idea that these atrocities took place, right? And
It's
they're
not
not willing.
something, it's not something taught in schools, that's for
It's
sure.
absolutely not. Yeah. And it's not the only time. I mean, I do a lot of work on Asia Pacific. It's the same in Japan. A lot of Japanese refuse to acknowledge what their army did in terms of atrocities, massive atrocities, millions of people in China and
And
Southeast
one
Asia.
thing that comes close is the rape of Nanjing, of course.
There you go. Yeah. Or the so-called comfort women, right? Forced sexual slaves. Those narratives are not at all addressed in modern Japan. So this is not unusual. It's just that, of course, the dimensions of it are staggering when you're looking at the Soviet Union. And that is illustrative of the kind of occupation that the Soviets intend to deploy throughout Eastern Europe, which is precisely what happens at the end of the war.
But before we go on to the concentration camps, I want to talk a little bit more about atrocities because, a lot of soldiers would get sexual diseases from these mass rapes. So how it wasn't easy to talk about. You couldn't talk about this if you got a sexual disease from raping a woman. So, you couldn't just go up to your officer. So I kind of got the call as a sexual disease there. What do I do? You probably would be shot if you, maybe not shot, but you wouldn't be court-martialed. That's
Yeah,
for
you
sure.
could.
If you
Yeah.
talked about this,
So you often didn't talk about it, or in the case of, again, I'm no expert on everything to do with, the Soviet military, but my understanding is that in a lot of cases, you kept it as quiet as possible, meaning inter-unit. The Soviets had medics, of course. They were notoriously bad and rudimentary, right? Because it wasn't their priority to save wounded soldiers. So you kind of dealt with it as best you could. And hopefully, your commander, where there was some real bonds in most units, there was a real bond to a frontline commander. Your commander would allow you to get medical treatment, or he would not want to know exactly what it was, right? They would sort of look the proverbial other way, because frankly, everybody would be executed, right? The nature of sexual conduct or misconduct during war is such that you'd have a hard time keeping your army together, right? But yeah, officially you could. I think there were statutes that you could get summarily executed, but most of the time the NKVD, that commissars of the NKVD were attached to most military units, so you had your buddies, your soldiers in the field, largely just regular people. And then depending on the size of the unit, there would be a commissar attached to it. And that was a political officer who was designed to patrol you guys, right? To make sure that you're loyal to Stalin and espousing communist rhetoric and so on. That's a really important part of the Soviet military. What's curious is that in many accounts, and there are quite a few of them, those commissars were isolated, right? The camaraderie of men fighting in the field was quite high. So, a lot of times edicts, even about political speech, for example, were widely ignored by commanders. And if you think about it, it kind of makes sense, right? Like I'm probably going to die tomorrow anyways, so why am I going to give my men a hard time? That's what a lot of commanders defied Stalin's orders, right? From the beginning of the war onwards, you just try to not make it too often the case. But I think when it comes to things like health, and even on occasion, political speech, like I said, some military commanders would intervene. They weren't always on side with the apparatchiks or the bureaucrats or the commissars in the field. So I think most of the men who contracted diseases, were treated as best as possible, or waited until the end of the war, frankly endured whatever ailment they had, gonorrhea, syphilis, or whatever, as long as they could. That's not the case for desertion, right? So some crimes were, a bullet in the head. They had one called the the ninth solution, if I'm not mistaken, in Russian, which is the size, millimeter size of a bullet. So, justice was summary when it came to things like desertion or cowardice. Sexual crimes not on the same par, they were widely ignored.
So let's talk about, you talked about it a little bit before, but let's talk about the concentration camps and the liberation, because as you know, Himmler did liberate a few like Auschwitz in hope to negotiate with the allies of with the prisoners from these concentration camps. But of course, before he killed himself, ended up killing himself. But let's talk about, because it wasn't a joyful liberation. They weren't cheered on when they liberated these concentration camps.
Yeah, I mean, you can actually see, I show photographs of it, and you can even see in some of those photographs the astonishment of Soviet commanders as they reach places like Auschwitz, which is really harrowing. I mean, you can imagine anyways, the nature of these camps. We all should and must try to imagine them. But when I see Soviet commanders, it reaches a new level because these were men that had seen the worst of the worst. They had endured their own country being burned to the ground and rape and murder and death on a scale that no country can imagine. And yet still they were astonished at the existence of these camps. That's really revealing, right? And some Russian accounts have that, right? There's some, journalists like Vasily Grossman and others who, wrote about that kind of reaction. I think that's in part because many of them couldn't imagine, which is kind of weird when you figure that there were death camps and disappearances and deportations in the Soviet state that they had grown up with. But still, they managed to shock. And yeah, they are liberated. And in a lot of cases, that liberation is genuine in the sense that the Soviets, which could also and had been very anti-Semitic in their own right, during the Second World War, that anti-Semitism dropped off, right, out of practical necessity. So, being Jewish in the front lines wasn't, being a Red Army soldier, for example, who was Jewish, wasn't necessarily a problem or anything like that. So, this is a very multinational, multi-ethnic, multi-religious army that reaches the camps, and I think that sense of shock and of revulsion is quite genuine. And they are relatively, at least to some, that liberation is real. People are allowed to return to their homes if they exist, and their families if they exist. The sinister part is that, particularly if you were of a political bend, if you were deemed dangerous by the Soviets in any way, your reinterment was assured. Right? So not at Auschwitz or Treblinka or camps that had been largely dismantled and destroyed, but at other camps like Sachsenhausen in Berlin, I think within weeks of liberation in April 1945, is a Soviet detention camp. I think Camp 21 or something renamed. So, the sad reality is that the Soviets, with full intent, are coming with the same sort of persecution in mind towards at least some members. Mostly political, that's for sure. Certainly German, but also, nationalists or resistance fighters, if you fell into their category. So the liberation of camps is astonishing and shocking. But that brings us to this point, which is we can't forget that the machinations of a guy like Stalin and his commanders are to some degree quite separate from the boys in the field, right? These were just average boys. Like they were doing an incredible and astonishing thing in their war effort, but they were still 19-year-old kids from farms in, Ukraine or whatever. And the shock of humanity, I think, of the scale of their suffering, really does reach them. That's evident in some Russian accounts of what the Nazis had done and so on. What's missing, of course, is the official narrative from the Soviet Union, which acknowledges German crimes, but none of their own, right? So they refused to have this discourse. So yeah, that is quite revealing, and it does lead, of course, much like in the Western Allies position, to a commitment for revenge. Right, on the German people, not just for their own losses, but on behalf of these crimes against humanity.
And something we haven't discussed so far is that when the soldiers entered beyond Poland, we are going to go on the other side a little bit, but I want to discuss this first. is that, the Soviet soldiers were angry, because why would they invade the Soviet Union when they really saw how much nicer things the Germans and Western Europe had that where they didn't have, so they were angry at the Germans.
Yeah, for sure.
Why would you attack us,
Yeah, that is a sentiment. A lot of Russian soldiers were astonished. I just wouldn't say that was their lead sentiment. I mean, I think by that point, it's hard to, narrate for millions of people one collective response or idea, right? You're talking about 12 million Russian soldiers by that point. I'm sure there are 12 million different opinions on a lot of things. Top of the list, certainly relief, right? Relief that this is over or coming to an end. Optimism and hope, as almost every human being would have, that their loved ones are still there, that they can return to some sense of normalcy. And then down the line, of course, a consideration of, oh my God, why would you attack us? I come from a poor village that doesn't have a road to it. And here you are living in relative opulence, right, and modernity. But of course, they were unable to see the why. They didn't fully understand the ideological perversions of the German state. They didn't, had any exposure to concepts of Lebensraum or Aryan supremacy. They had no notions of, or very few notions of Hitler's intentions. And they also didn't really understand the military, strategic, economic factors that led to the invasion of the Soviet Union, right? And of course, as we all know, it was two things. It was that design for, conquest, imperial conquest, vast economic resources to turn the Soviet Union into basically a giant farm for the expansion of German people and for the
course.
Große Deutsch, the idea of a larger Germany, but also simultaneously a racial cleansing, right? A racial and ethnic cleansing.
Annihilation
So
of the
these
entire
guys.
Slavic people.
There you go. They and their enslavement or execution. So they couldn't have possibly known all of that. But yeah, there are accounts of Russian soldiers astonished, and it's usually vented out, of course, in the most violent of ways, right? And through rape and through summary executions, and through pillaging, right? People stole stuff as much as they could, not just individual soldiers, but as I'm sure you know, the Red Army as a whole, right? One of the first things it does everywhere it sets up shop in Eastern Europe is to grab everything that's valuable, personal belongings all the way to state infrastructure, because Stalin wants that to happen. He wants this to be a kind of repayment for the Russian war effort, economic and otherwise. And also it's much needed in a state that has yes, won the Second World War, but drained itself so sizably of all of its resources. So, the responses in that frustration and question that you're asking, is again the idea of a ruthless response.
So we talked a lot about the Soviet side, and this is mo very much about the Soviet invasion of Berlin. But I, of course, also want to talk about the last days in the Führerbunker. I feel it's important to talk about as
Yeah.
well. Of course, they're
Yeah.
famously portrayed in the Untergang, but let's talk about the last few days in the Führerbunker.
Yeah. I mean, sheer terror is the general description for Germans, not necessarily Hitler, but for the German people, because the reality is painfully obvious to them. That most of the Russian advance had been sanitized by virtue of propaganda until you get to the, Vistula Oder campaign, right, where the Russians pour in and make headlong, rapid gains across the two rivers, and then sit outside of Berlin. And when that happens, certainly by April of 1945, everybody knows the end is nigh. Russians shell the city in such fashion that, it's hard to imagine. They're, of course, bombing it too. So most Berliners were terrified. There was mass number of refugees from German holdings in the east. It's chaos in so many different ways. And yet it's also this ridiculous picture, as movies like The Untergang show. There's also this bizarre, sort of tragic play that's going on where Hitler and the commanders still imagine that there are armies in the field, right? Famously, he was commanding armies that basically didn't exist anymore, right? He's giving orders to Steiner's army, and Steiner has long given up the ghost. So, you know, there's that added tragic thing that the sense of arrogance and superiority so deep in Germany that most people imagine some sort of, you know, heroic victory that the hand of God would deliver them. But most commanders were acutely aware that the end was coming very, very fast. So the only, you know, there's no good news for Germans, of course, but importantly, their defiance is a very real and important thing. Like, even though the odds are pretty much done, or your fate is sealed, still people show up to defend Berlin, right? You know, famously women and children, right? You know, you have 13-year-old kids in the home army now defending German state, old men, you know, wounded soldiers. And the madness that follows is really quite acute. It's one of the many reasons I'm so interested in these narratives. You know, even with victory at hand, the Russians still waste human life to get Berlin, right? 70,000 Russian soldiers die in the siege of Berlin, which is a monstrous amount of men for any army. For Russia, maybe a pittance compared to their other losses. But that shows you the bizarre nature of the end of the war. Why would you commit so many men to house, street to street fighting in a city full of rubble, defended by teenagers with, you know, virtually no weapons? And that speaks fundamentally to the Soviet design on victory, on, you know, punishing the German state, on being the first to the German capital. All really important things, but not any more needed. You know full well by that stage, Eisenhower, the Supreme Commander of Allied Forces, had basically said, we don't want Berlin, right? So there's no real imperative for the Russians to spend that kind of life, but they do. And it's the same on the German side. Like certainly, you know, it speaks to the ideological conviction, the perversion of the German state, that you would still have young girls coming out to fight against Russian soldiers in the streets of Berlin. It's utterly bizarre. And then the rats leave the ship, right? Most tellingly, most senior commanders and political officials either took their own lives or got the hell out. So the cowards are gone, and what's left are these, you know, really desperate and very poor Berliners who somehow think, you know, victory can be salvaged if they go into the streets with a pistol, you know, against Russian armies. It's an unbelievable tragedy. And it is a city of rubble, right? So like I always show my students images of Berlin. I taught in Berlin. I lived in Berlin. And I show them the images of Berlin in 1945. And it is literally a city of rubble. It's unimaginable what's there to defend or to conquer. So yeah, in the bunker, of course, you have the architect of madness there, of doom, in Hitler. You know, giving commands to fictitious armies, imagining a post-war German state, and then simultaneously in his drug-induced state of mind, imagining some sort of legacy out of this, but to the end, prepared to commit his people to death and destruction. Right? He had no respect for his own people. You know, famously, he allegedly, at least to survivors who recounted it, you know, went on about how the German people brought this on themselves because they were inadequate. They didn't fight hard enough. They're not as superior as we thought. Utter sheer madness. So yeah, bullet in the head, and that's about the best fate that he could have possibly imagined. Because of course, if the Russians had got him, it would have been a much crueler fate than that. But not before he, you know, condemned even more people to the grave. Right? This is what you get as a ruthless dictator. Harrowing moments and well documented in a lot of cases. I hope you're not going to ask me about conspiracy stuff, whether or not, you know, it was actually
I'm
Hitler
tempted
that.
to, but
Yeah,
I'm
I
gonna leave
don't
it
think
be.
nothing is true along those lines. I think, you know, what we have is what we have. He shot himself. You know, a body is
Heard they have a
destroyed.
Brown before.
They have a Brahm, their dog, you know, the whole nine yards. More interesting to me are the other rats that leave the ship, as it were. You know, your guys like Himmler and Göring and others who try to flee. And you know, what better example of the cowardice of the Nazis at the end of the day than Heinrich Himmler, the supreme commander of the SS, you know, trying to dress up like a civilian and run away with refugees, right, before he's caught. So, you know, the dying days are absolutely illustrative of the madness of the German state, the hubris of Hitler. And of course, the price that the Soviets are still prepared, the vengeance, the hatred, the I mean, listen, I having taught in Berlin, I led classes out into the field, right, as part of your course, and you show them, the Führerbunker, which is now commemorated by a small plaque, and it's adjacent to a parking lot for a residential complex, right? So it's the most, sort of innocuous place in the world. Down the street is a kindergarten, where one of the entryways used to be. People are shocked. Like they often say, why isn't this commemorated more? How do you commemorate the Nazis with any sort of sense of dignity? But there's a certain poetic nature to that, all the tragedy notwithstanding. And then I remind them that, around every corner, every mailbox that we see on the street, Soviet soldiers fought over rubble to be the first to claim to make it to the bunker, to make it to the chancellery in the bunker. And 70,000 of them spent their lives. So the Siege of Berlin speaks not just about German hubris and German arrogance and German defeat, but also about the commitment and the madness of the Soviets to take a city full of rubble.
And I've got to ask, of course, before we move on to the victory parade, how accurate do you think their underground portrays? And it's a, I feel like it's a must-see movie, but how accurate do you feel like it portrays the final days of Hitler and the world, Second World War?
Yeah, you know what? I actually really love that film. I'm hypercritical of most films. That one makes some mistakes too. And again, I'm no, movie guy and no expert on every minute detail. But my understanding from my own opinion, as well as talking to other people who study this stuff, is that it's quite good in portraying the last days. Now, that being said, it is the last days as largely accounted for from his secretary, right? So there's a kind of, broken telephone process here, but. In terms of what I really liked about that movie is not just the portrayal of Hitler himself, which I think was a great acting job. Not everybody would agree, but I thought so. But the precision, I noticed that in the scenes of the bunker when they when Goebbels' family is killed, when the dog, Hitler's dog is killed, somebody had the presence of mind to move the clock on the wall to the times that we know it actually happened, right? So there, from a movie making perspective, I thought it was quite accurate. And then I really liked the portrayal of the Soviet soldiers. You don't see them much, but in the closing scenes, the secretary tries to leave,
The machine walks among the girls, the
Yeah,
soldiers.
and while it's a little bit stereotypical to have drunk Russians in the milieu, that certainly happened. Their faces are really extraordinary. There's the director or producer, whoever, had the presence of mind to remember that that army was a polyglot army, right? It's a bunch of different ethnic minorities, Kazakhs and Tatars and, Azeris and so on, all very young and, of course, very jubilant about victory and uncertain what to do. So there's a lot of sort of, minute human factors that I quite liked in portraying it. And it does stand as one of the sort of better movies to account for that. But we don't know absolutely every last moment in the bunker. I don't know that we ever will. But contrary to some conspiracy theories, there are pretty well documented accounts. So I am not one of those guys that will tell you Hitler's skull is really in a museum in the Kremlin, hidden away from public purview, or that there's an elaborate tunnel system underneath, that has real Nazis living in it or something like that. That doesn't make much sense. What does make sense is the Russians taking the chancellery and then, of course, taking the Reichstag and leveling Berlin, at least from their perspective, occupying Berlin and killing as many Nazis as possible. That's their objective, and the job is done, right? So, in that light, it kind of amazes me why people go on and on about, to some newspapers here, at least, tabloid as they are, Hitler's still alive in Peru somewhere. He's now what, 207 or something like that. But the facts are the facts. I
He
mean,
would have
that
been
kid.
90, I calculated. He would have been 90 in 1970, so.
Yeah, he's long dead, and it makes a lot of sense. Even some of the guys who got away, right? Some of the German officials that we never heard from again, now through a lot of exhaustive research and analysis, most of them are being found, right, dead, of course, as a result of the war. So I like the facts a lot more, and in that sense, there's more than enough in World War II from a Soviet perspective to keep us asking questions and finding things out hundreds of years to come.
And of course, let's talk about the infamous victory parade that was arranged after. We don't have time to go into the Nuremberg trials or anything like that today, unfortunately, but we are going to skip directly to the victory parade in Moscow. And it's actually available on YouTube to watch. And after this episode, you should absolutely watch it on YouTube. It's a fascinating piece of film. And so let's talk about when, I don't believe it was Suko who was riding the horse, was it? Because it was raining that day as well. So let's talk about the victory parade at the
Yeah,
end.
well, it's legendary, right? There is the main victory parade, and of course there are a lot of smaller ones, right, which don't capture as much attention. It's massive, right? It's a shadow of the war itself, this massive enterprise. It's artful in a lot of ways. It's exhaustive in representing all the different units and the different services and the role of women. There's a couple of exceptions, right, for people that aren't allowed to partake. Partisans are not terribly well, documented for political reasons. Some other groups are also omitted. But this is really a triumph, for Joseph Stalin, a man who had in effect lost the war, now gets to preside. And it is extremely important for the Soviet Union because of the sacrifice, keeping in mind, of course, that the full dimensions of its sacrifice were not known to its own people yet, let alone to the outside world. And it is an opportunity to demonstrate the teeth that the Soviet had. We should never forget that, right? Victory parades aren't just celebratory and innocent. It is designed to remind the Russian people of their greatness, and to remind any outsiders, if they, are able to see it, or hear of it, that this is a Soviet victory, and that the Soviet Union is now, as you well know, already by 1945, at great odds with the Western allies, right? We have the beginning of the Cold War. And then there's a further politic to it, right? On the podium, the question is who stands with Stalin, right? Because whoever stands with Stalin gets sanction as a sort of architect of victory. And you're probably, well aware, as most people are, that Stalin was not comfortable having Zhukov, their fame, Georgi Zhukov, their famous general, on the podium, because he didn't want to share in this victory, right? The reality is that Stalin, who was an active military commander more than most, made some horrendous mistakes in the beginning of the war, and then somewhat quietly, as the war progressed, started to defer more to his generals, Zhukov, top of the list. So many people, of course, recognized him as the real hero of the Soviet Union. And that becomes a problem, right? So commemoration is now a new battlefront, if you like, from a Soviet perspective. How do you monument these things? How do you deal with it? And frankly, it's still much more so than in the Western world. Those kind of commemorations and those parades, every May, are still really important. I've been to some myself, right, in Russia. Even if they're now devoid of actual veterans, those parades are really elemental to Russian national identity, right? So it's a very long-lasting effect. But that is a great parade, and it is something to behold and to watch. It just doesn't speak the full narratives of either Russian losses, of Russian incompetence, or of the Russian brutality that they inflicted themselves.
Now, before we round up, we talked about a lot of the atrocities and rape of the innocent women in during the invasion, and I want to talk about this a little bit before we round up. But of course, what we didn't talk much about what they left behind, but on the road to victory. So let's talk about the aftermath of these women who were victims of these rape mass rapes that occurred. And some, some shot themselves, some couldn't do that any longer. But what happened to a lot of those, and how were they? Because I'm assuming a lot of did give birth to offsprings from these soldiers as a result of the rape as well. So let's talk a little bit about the women that were left behind
Well,
before we round up.
those are excellent questions. That's part of this idea that I keep bringing up about narratives that we need to explore. And that's true globally. It's not just in the Russian context. How many comfort women under Japanese rule gave birth, or were in other ways, victims of the war. There's no simple answer. The fact is that in places like Germany, there were no resources for them. Resources as you and I would find them today. There was no counseling, no medical care really to speak of. So they were largely left to their own. And in many cases, that meant to their neighbors and friends, right, who would help them medically and psychologically as best as possible. A lot
How
did
were
flow
they
in.
viewed? Were they down upon by the fellow
Absolutely, yeah.
immigrants?
There's a psychological process that goes on for many years, right? The stigma that's attached to them. In some cases, it's because they were deemed to be collaborationist, right? It was the same, for other populations. Norway's no different. If a Norwegian woman had been raped by a German soldier, she was thought to be a collaborationist, right?
If a Norwegian girl dated a soldier, she was cut off her
Absolutely.
hair at the knee, and she was frowned upon for the rest of her life. If she
Absolutely.
dated
And in some
a
cases,
German
they were,
soldier.
publicly humiliated, in many cases beaten, some cases killed, right? That's a repeat episode throughout occupied Europe, France, Holland, it doesn't matter. In this particular case, in the devastation of Germany, there's really no resources for them. So they're highly dependent upon their own circle of friends. Some killed themselves, you're absolutely right. Others just pretended like it didn't happen. So they tried to blend back into a state of normalcy. We shouldn't forget that many of these women, where they had husbands or partners, sometimes even brothers or fathers, they didn't often come home, right? So sometimes these women had the additional burden of not knowing if their partner, brother, or father was alive. And there's a really big element here that I always talk about, which is the emasculation of the German manhood, right? Germany's defeat wasn't just a military and political thing. It also was, in effect, a social cultural thing. So women had to be unbelievably strong and resilient. And they were. Like in post-war Berlin, the vast majority of work being done on the streets, cleanup and everything else, was done by the so-called Trümmerfrauen in German, the rubble women, because they live in the rubble, they live off the rubble, they rebuild the city. And I can't imagine the horrors, much like women in Moscow or Stalingrad or other places had to endure unspeakable conditions. So did the women of Berlin with that additional thing of defeat. So yeah, there's a mixed variety. Some wrote about it, right? Some, didn't talk about it for a long time and then tried to talk about it. Others just tried to blend right back in. But I can't, neither in a general sense, nor obviously as not being a woman, I can't imagine what they went through psychologically and politically. But yeah, they were shunned, right? And a lot of people were shunned by that association, whether or not it was voluntary is immaterial.
I think it was rather dim point of view to dim part to round it up, but I think we're gonna end this here. There's so much more we could have discussed on this topic. I'm sure I will revisit it sometime in the future as well.
Sure.
But before we go, do you have anything you want to promote on the social media where people might find you if they want to know more? Any books you want to share with us that are links in the description that you wanted to share?
Yeah. Do I want to share anything? Is that what you're
Yeah,
asking me?
that's
Sure. Well,
fine.
they can listen. I'm always open. My email is out there. You can, I think, well, you have it. You can post it. I have a website. I'm going to develop a better one as I'm trying to become more media savvy, but I'm always open to dialogue and discussion. I get a lot of people from around the world. I do a fair amount of media. I do a lot of TV shows here in North America, oddly enough, on the Nazis. So, I can refer them to that. And I've written quite a lot as well. So, I'm always available. I'm always interested in these discourses, especially international, right? I like, talking to people from all over the world. So yeah, I'm pretty out there, and I always welcome discourse of any kind. Sometimes I'm slow to get back to it, so you can tell your listeners
I
that.
can
So
testify to
like any prop, yeah,
that
but here I am, right?
Yes.
Voluntarily, here I am. So, sooner or later, but I like it. I get a lot of I had somebody a couple of weeks ago from France email me about some personal possessions they had from Hermann Goering, right? That they're
Oh.
presumably honored. So it's a curious mix of things. I get a lot of academic questions. I get a lot from students. around the world, and for the most part, I'm very happy to engage in discourse anytime on this topic or others. And the other thing I'd say is that listen, this is the time more than any other time, as the world is in war and a war that is largely orchestrated by Russia. This is the time that we should start exploring these histories even more than before, because there's a lot of historical elements to
Absolutely.
Putin and his madness. So, stuff like this that you're doing is great. I wish we did this a lot more often.
Thank you so much for coming on, Arne. It's been
My
a
pleasure.
pleasure. And
Thank
before
you.
this has been well that I should well, we are available on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, YouTube, wherever you can find podcasts. If you want the time, please consider writing a little review on Apple or iTunes. That would help us out. You check us out on social media on Twitter and Instagram and with that H12. My name is Alan. Please like, share, and subscribe. And I'll see you next time.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.